Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, Joshua 4 tells us how he developed the best memory in America.
It's actually about basically painting a picture in your mind's eye of a scene that is so colorful and strange and unlike anything you've seen before that you're not going to forget it.
Julie Bosman has notes from the field. Frank Bruni discusses a new food memoir.
You finish the book, you understand full well how she ended up founding the restaurant Prune, why it ended up being the kind of restaurant it is, but she doesn't do that in a kind of ham-handed expository fashion.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. All that after the break.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
Joshua 4 not only belongs to one of America's most distinguished and accomplished literary families, he at one point, we'll find out if he still does, certifiably had the best memory on the planet, or at least in America. He's the author of a new book. It's called Moonwalking with Einstein, The Art and Science of Remembering Everything. It's reviewed for us by Alexandra Horowitz, who says that Joshua 4's narrative is suspenseful and riotous. I'm delighted that Josh 4 is here to talk about his book. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, you have to tell us how you did this thing, because a reader is going to find himself in a room with you while you are competing to display the best memory there is. So how did you get here? What did you do?
It's a totally weird story. Basically, I had gone to one of these events called the United States Memory Championship to write what I thought was going to be a little 1,200-word article about what I figured was going to be the Super Bowl of savants. I really didn't know what I was stepping into.
When was this?
This was in 2005.
Okay.
And the individuals I met there kept telling me, well, actually, we're not savants. We don't have photographic memory. Rather, we've trained our memories to perform these amazing gymnastic feats.
In fact, you have a phrase, you call them mental athletes.
They call themselves mental athletes. And by the way, they call their sport a mental decathlon because there are 10 events. And one of the mental athletes I met there was a guy named Ed Cook, who had one of the best memories from England. Anyways, Ed said, you know, I could teach you how to do this. And I didn't really fully believe him, but it was such a compelling promise that I felt like I should take him up on it. And over the course of the next year, I basically trained my memory and also spent a lot of time really trying to understand it, how it works, why it sometimes fails us, and, you know, where its limits might be.
Now, Joshua, many of our readers and listeners will have read the cover story in the New York Times Magazine based on your book, but some won't. So describe some of the gymnastics, the training that you do to develop this kind of memory.
So mental athletes see themselves as attempting to resurrect a lost ancient art, which goes back to ancient Greece and supposedly to the poet Simonides, who discovered a technique known as the memory palace, which involves essentially creating an imagined edifice in your mind, in your mind's eye, and populating that building with images of whatever it is that you want to remember. So if you were, you know, trying to remember a list of a shopping list, say, you would put images of whatever it is, you know, your eggs at the front door and your quarter pound of chicken right inside the front door. Those techniques, which were developed in ancient Greece and you might say perfected by Romans like Cicero, who used them to memorize his, you know, stem winders, were a part of a classical education in the liberal arts, you know, grammar, logic, rhetoric, and memory. People learned not only the things they had to remember, but how to remember them.
And how long did this continue? How long was this a part of one's classical education?
Through the Middle Ages, I mean, during the Renaissance, these techniques got wrapped up in a whole host of kind of wacky ideas that were in the air and then sort of disappeared, only to be resurrected, you might say, for this singular and bizarre competition. And it's actually not just one competition, but a whole kind of circuit of competitions held all over the world that culminate in a world memory championship. And so having spent a little bit less than a year training with this fella, Ed Cook, as my coach, I ended up coming back to the following year's U.S. Memory Championship to compete, thinking, well, not entirely sure what I was thinking, but hoping that it might be sort of an interesting afterword to something I was going to write about this whole strange subculture of people who compete and try to train their memories. And lo and behold, I won the contest, which sort of wasn't supposed to happen.
How long did the contest last?
It's a full day.
It's one day.
Yeah.
And what are some of the competitions?
So there's a poem that you have to memorize. There's one of the events involves five strangers getting up on stage and just reeling off all of this biographical information. You know, my name is such and such. My phone number is such and such. My pets' names are whatever. These are my favorite foods. And then steps down and somebody else comes up and does the same thing. And you have to recall as much of that as you can.
Now, for our literary listeners, what poem did you have to memorize? Or was it one they composed for you?
It's typically a previously unpublished poem. Interestingly enough, in the World Memory Championships, for many years, the poem was written by Ted Hughes, who was a friend of the founder of the sport of competitive memory. I fortunately lucked out because of some quirks in the competition. I didn't have to actually memorize the poem on game day. I got a bye from that round. Happened to be my worst event, so I was plenty happy with that.
So when you are tested in this way, so five people get up with great detail and I assume maybe some rapidity, run through their autobiographies. Then how are you tested on that and who tests you?
The test for that particular event involves that person coming back up on stage maybe 15 minutes later and the competitors being essentially quizzed. You know, what was this woman's zip code? What were the names of her cats? That sort of thing.
And you're all quizzed separately?
I think they try and bring some of the kabuki theater of the spelling bee into this. To make it as dramatic as possible, they've got us sitting up on stage on director's chairs, and we're going sort of person by person, each one hoping that the one next to him will trip and fail so that the phone number doesn't end up being my responsibility to recall that.
So it takes place over a day. You've won.
Right.
And then what happens?
And then I find myself in the very strange position of being the official representative of the United States of America to the World Memory Championships. I really had not expected to be in that position.
Where were they held or where were they going to be held?
They were held in London that year. And I basically decided, well, this is hilarious. I got to go for it now. And so I ended up having a Team USA t-shirt. I had my earmuffs painted with the stars and stripes and decided I would go and try and give the world a good impression of American collective memory.
Right. Not just a mental athlete in your case, but a real mental jock, like a gung-ho mental jock.
Huh? Yeah. It's a funny image, but it's that was sort of how it was, yeah.
How much time did you spend? You said a year. Mm-hmm. So every day, hours a day? I mean, is it boring to do this?
So the best guys in the world do this hours a day, every day of the week. I never quite reached that level. I should say that Americans on the competitive memory circuit are sort of like Jamaican bobsledders. We're not quite the German powerhouses or the Malaysian powerhouses of this sport. So yeah, so I was trying to do a little bit every day between when I woke up and sat down and read my New York Times. And over time, I just got better and better at it. And partially that was because I had not only this coach, Ed Cook, who was teaching me all of these very fancy European techniques for remembering.
So this is like being a chess master or something in his case.
In fact, Ed Cook is a grandmaster of memory. That's an actual title. And you achieve that title by memorizing a deck of cards in under 2 minutes, 1,000 random numbers in an hour, and 10 decks of playing cards in an hour. That was a level I never reached.
I'm going to ask you a really dumb question.
Go for it.
Is it possible to do this and not really be all that smart, or do you have to be very smart to do this?
The art of this, which I was surprised to learn, is actually it's not so much about memory. It's actually about basically painting a picture in your mind's eye of a scene that is so colorful and strange and unlike anything you've seen before that you're not going to forget it. So what these guys are training to do and what I trained to do was basically do that very quickly. Imagine things that would be unforgettable. And that's as much, I think, a skill that's sort of a creative act as anything having to do with memory. Women tend to go about some of the events differently than men, which I thought was fascinating, especially when it comes to memorizing poetry. The men come at it with this super methodical method that actually dates back to a Greek named Metrodorus, and they go and try and create an image for every word in a poem, and it's quite methodical.
An image for every single word.
Exactly. Whereas some of the women will say, well, actually, I'm going to go about this more like an actor or an actress learning a script and really try and break up a poem into beats and associate an emotion with every beat and try and feel what the poem is about. It's a much more pleasant sounding way of memorizing poetry.
Are they equally effective? Depends on the person, I suppose.
It does. It's one of the events that I think is most consistently won by women. I think that's true. I'm not 100% sure these days.
You mean you can't remember?
It's been a while since I hung up my cleats.
Thanks a lot, Joshua Foer, whose new book, Moonwalking with Einstein, The Art and Science of Remembering Everything, is reviewed in this week's book review.
Thank you.
Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So another installment of the Borders saga.
Yes, we have a little bit more bad news from Borders. The New York Stock Exchange said this week that it will delist Borders stock on March 21st. This was a widely expected move, and this is something the stock exchange does after a stock trades at less than $1 for a consecutive 30-day period, and Borders is currently trading at about 22 cents. So everyone knew this was coming, but it's another drop in the bucket of bad news.
And I know we've talked about this before. How damaging is this to the book publishers themselves, who have lots of inventory with Borders? Are they now just kind of scrambling to recover whatever they can? And if so, how do they do it?
Well, some of them are trying to get some of their inventory back. And Borders has not really said what they're going to do about that. But we saw this week that a couple of small publishers have been appealing to Borders and saying, look, just give us our books back. But right now, Borders is meeting with publishers this week. They've been trying to resume a normal business relationship because they're still in a situation where publishers are not shipping directly to Borders. Borders is getting most of its new books through Ingram, which is a wholesaler and sort of a middleman between retailers and publishers. And so far, you know, publishers say that they're open to shipping to Borders again, but they want to do it on their terms. And that generally involves cash on delivery or something that will make publishers feel confident enough to resume a normal business relationship with Borders.
Julie, with this kind of death vigil going forward, what about book buyers? Is Borders likely still to be in business? Can they go around the corner and visit? Or are they kind of one by one being eliminated in different places?
Well, Borders has filed Chapter 11 bankruptcy, which allows them to remain operating while liquidating some of their stores. And right now, Borders is in the process of a lot of going out of business sales. That applies to about something like 200, 250 stores, and that number may go up in the coming weeks. But for other stores, it's business as usual.
Now, what about some white knight riding in at the last minute to rescue Borders or buy the concern, you know, take over the business? No talk of that?
No sign of any white knights yet. I mean, we have seen some talk that some of the Borders locations that are currently being liquidated may be taken over by another bookstore. Books a Million has indicated that's interested in a couple of locations, but we don't know yet. And it doesn't seem like there's any rescue plan that we know of.
Thanks a lot, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Next, Frank Bruni, former restaurant critic for the New York Times, tells us about a food memoir written by one of New York City's best chefs.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. One audiobook to consider is The Woman Warrior, Memoirs of a Girlhood Among Ghosts by Maxine Hong Kingston. Chinese folklore, autobiography, history, and fantasy are artfully blended in this candid story about the daughter of Chinese immigrants in mid-20th century California. That's The Woman Warrior, available from Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookreview.
This is the age of chefs who are pretty good writers and sometimes very good writers. There's a new memoir. It's called Blood, Bones, and Butter, The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef. The author is Gabrielle Hamilton, well-known in Manhattan. The reviewer is even better known, at least to many of our listeners, Frank Bruni, former restaurant critic for The New York Times and now a staff writer at The New York Times Magazine. And he's here to talk about it. Welcome, Frank.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, what story is Gabrielle telling in her book?
She's telling, in a sense, I want to say a familiar story because it is the kind of memoir we've come to expect from people in the food world. I mean, at this point, this many years into this food obsession this country's in the grip of, we've seen a lot of memoirs of people who are well-known in a culinary sense in some way and who then kind of trace their relationship with food, their love of food, how they came to where they ended up, which is this place in the public imagination. So she's talking about her childhood. She's talking about becoming a chef. She's talking about why she became a chef, what it meant to her. To her credit, it's not approached that explicitly. You finish the book, you understand full well how she ended up founding the restaurant Prune, why it ended up being the kind of restaurant it is, but she doesn't do that in a kind of ham-handed expository fashion. She lets you read into what she's written and come to those conclusions for yourself.
So quickly, what's your story? Where is she from?
She's from the rural New Jersey, right near the Pennsylvania border, or vice versa. I'd have to look back at the chapter. I read the book a couple weeks ago. She's from a rural area about a couple hours outside the city. She grew up in a sort of bohemian family. She finished high school early and ends up in New York at age 16. And I think one of the best stretches of the book is when she talks about being 16, 17, 18 in New York City, kind of scrounging to make a living, using pilfered ketchup packets to make some version of tomato sauce for, you know, cheap noodles in a Manhattan kitchen. I think a lot of people who've had a phase of their life where they were really scrounging to save money or to make a little bit go a long way will find a lot of kind of familiar notes in that very well-written stretch about being so young and so poor in New York City.
Now, when she first came to New York, Frank, was it her idea to be a restaurateur or chef? Was she a food person already, or is that something she developed over
time?
No,
she had stumbled into restaurants back when she was 13, 14, 15 in her rural area. Her family hit financial hard times and her parents got divorced. And there's this kind of unusual period where she and her siblings seem left almost to fend for themselves. She needed work. She needed stuff. She stole a little bit, you know, became a little bit of a shoplifter. And she lied about her age to get a job washing dishes and doing some other stuff in a restaurant. So very early on, she realized a restaurant was a kind of loosey-goosey place that you could, you know, talk or fib or just swagger your way into to make some money. So she comes to New York. She's waiting tables for a while. And it's almost as if restaurants are these magnets that keep drawing her back. Like it's just – it's what she knows. It's what feels comfortable. She begins cooking. That feels right. And you also realize that since so many of her fondest memories of her parents and of this sort of childhood idyll that collapsed, since so many of those memories are about food and the table, you realize that she's really being emotionally pulled toward the world of food and toward the world of hospitality and taking care of people. And by the time she starts the restaurant Prune, which has become so famous in Manhattan many years later, you realize that its particular homey atmosphere and its ethos has everything to do with wanting to take care of people and create a home for people in the way she wished had lasted longer in her own childhood.
Now, what about her personal life?
You know, as memorable as so much of the book is, I think it's also a flawed book. And one of the big flaws is the way she addresses her personal life. I got the sense she did not want this to become a memoir of the bedroom. She wanted it to be a memoir of the kitchen. But because of that, there are all sorts of things she glides right over that leave a reader feeling cheated. For example, she makes a couple references, and now we're like a little later along in her 20s, 30s, I'm not sure exactly where, to a woman she met in Michigan when she was doing a writer's program and that she fell, you know, very much much in love with and was crazy about. She mentions that it's sort of the first time she confronts or acknowledges, you know, being a lesbian for many years, doesn't really go that much into it. And then we're back in New York and she's having an affair with an Italian man who she winds up marrying and having two kids with. And there's never so much as a paragraph that kind of addresses head on how she went from one to the other and what that meant about her feelings about romance or intimacy or sex. And I felt very dislocated by that. I didn't want something smutty or long-winded, but for some people, that sort of ability to switch affections from one gender to another is something of a surprise, and it raises a – not prurient, but just a kind of question. Oh, how did that feel in your own head and heart? She never goes there.
And why would that be?
Why would she not go there?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know her. I only know the book and I know her restaurant because I've eaten at it and in fact reviewed it when I was a restaurant critic. I mean, I did get the sense that it was a conscious decision. It was a decision to write one kind of book and not another. And I think it is a delicate thing to handle. Go too far into that direction and you're writing a different book than the one you set out to write. I think she went not far enough in that direction. I think she just had to kind of address it a little bit. The problem for me with that and with a couple of other things in the book that aren't well explained, like toward the end, she has this chapter where she goes back to see her mother. And she is just, I mean, full of the most red-hot anger toward her mother. And it has a logical explanation in terms of her mother kind of abandoned her when she was a kid. But after that happens, her mother drifts out of the narrative entirely. She never kind of clues you in to this feeling of anger and abandonment. 100 pages go by, and then suddenly she's describing her mother as this horrible black widow spider, and she hasn't set the stage for this fury that she's feeling. That sort of thing and the romantic stuff I'm talking about, it makes a memoir that I don't think was meant to be guarded feel a little bit guarded and evasive. I think that it's crucial when you're reading a memoir to kind of really, really bond with it, to feel like the author is not holding anything back or keeping anything in the closet. And while that may not have been her motive, some of these blind spots or some of this absent connective tissue in the book made me feel a little bit like she wasn't being utterly, utterly forthcoming with me in the way that I expect someone writing something as intimate as a memoir to be.
Thanks a lot, Frank.
Thank you.
That's Frank Bruni, who this week reviews Blood, Bones, and Butter by Gabrielle Hamilton. Jennifer Schussler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
Tell me what's new on the list this week.
Well, we do have a lot of new books on the list, both fiction and nonfiction. Starting with nonfiction, kind of surprisingly to me, Gabrielle Hamilton enters at number two with her memoir Blood, Bones, and Butter, which we heard a little bit about earlier on the podcast from Frank Bruni. Hamilton's restaurant, Prune, down in the East Village, only has about 20 seats, but she's obviously feeding a lot more people with this book. And there's another very literary memoir on the list, too. Andre Dubuque III enters at number 13 with his memoir, Townie. He's well known for his novel, House of Sand and Fog, which I believe made the fiction list several years ago. And here he writes about his hardscrabble childhood in some very depressed Massachusetts mill towns where he smoked a lot of pot, got in a lot of fistfights, and spent a lot of time hating his mostly absent father, the fiction writer Andre Dubuque Jr.
Well, I have to tell you, Jenny, a few years ago, I attended the annual Book Expo in Los Angeles, is where it was held that year, and Andre Dubuque spoke, and he was riveting.
The father or the son?
The son.
Uh-huh.
And one of the other panelists was Magic Johnson, the great basketball player, who hung on every word Dubuque said and then went over and shook his hand afterward and hugged him. It was really quite a thing.
Yeah. Well, in addition to being a beautiful writer, he's quite a tough guy. Although I have to say, if it came down to a street fight, I might put my money on Gabrielle Hamilton. She's got a lot of knives. And according to this memoir, she also knows how to haul a maggot-infested rat out of a kitchen.
Whoa. What about fiction?
New book at number one, Patrick Rothfuss, the fantasy writer, is back with his latest. It's called The Wise Man's Fear, and it continues the story of the magician Kvothe, who tells his fantastical life story. Interestingly, Rothfuss has never made the hardcover list before. His last book spent a couple weeks on the mass market paperback list, so I think we're really seeing the continuing strength of this fantasy genre. And back in the real world, Jodi Picoult enters at number two with her latest. It's called Sing You Home, Pico likes to write about social issues, social problems. Here she takes on the issue of gay rights, and she is writing about a music therapist who desperately wants a child, and the book comes with a CD.
Wow. Now, this week you wrote about a new study showing the sales impact of reviews, particularly our reviews.
Yes. Kingsley Amis once said that a bad review should ruin your breakfast but not your lunch. Apparently, it shouldn't ruin your sales either, at least not if you are a relatively unknown writer. A team of researchers at Stanford Business School looked at the impact on sales of reviews that appeared in the New York Times. And what they found was actually pretty interesting. For little-known writers, just getting a review would raise your sales about 30%. It didn't really matter if the reviews were favorable or unfavorable. For well-known writers, the Jody Picos, James Pattersons of the world, the picture was a little bit different. A negative review tended to lead to a roughly 15% decrease in sales, but a positive review led to a bump of 42%.
So probably on average, you're better off being reviewed because the gains are going to outweigh the losses, maybe, as long as you get some favorable reviews.
Exactly. But I'm not sure that is going to give a lot of comfort to those writers who do get negative reviews.
Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.